You're listening to WYLL. I'm Chris Berube. During the Arab Spring, most people got their news from Twitter, and one man managed to make himself a hub for a lot of newsreaders. Andy Carvin works for NPR, but he's not a reporter. Last year, Carvin tweeted incessantly, sometimes over 100 times an hour, spreading videos, rumors, and stories that would have gone unnoticed from across Egypt, Libya, and Tunisia. Carvin provided important context for many readers, but some media critics were uncomfortable with his retweeting of unverified rumors and the fact that he did all of his work from outside of the Middle East. Carvin has now written a book about the Arab Spring called Distant Witness. He says even though he did most of his work from the United States, many readers made the mistake of thinking that he was on the scene.
I remember at one point, and I believe it was late February 2011, I was in Palm Springs, California, attending a TED conference of some sort. And at the end of it, I had a few hours to kill, so I decided to go hang out by the pool and just relax for a bit. And I took out my phone and I started catching up on Twitter, and I saw a tweet from someone said, "I just wanted to let you know that my church and I are praying for your safety in Libya right now." So I wrote back and I thanked her and her church for their concern, but ironic that they were concerned about my safety in one desert, whereas the desert I was in, I honestly only had to worry about a suntan burning too hard. It was flattering that there were so many people out there who were concerned about my safety, but it did definitely demonstrate the changing landscape of how journalists use new tools for reporting, because I can totally understand that from a member of the public's perspective, if they were just observing my tweeting in real time and they happened to miss one of my tweets, reminding them that I'm not on the scene, that they could assume that I was. Reminding people of the context is important. In many ways, it's actually not that different than doing radio, because if a person tunes in at the wrong moment, they might get the wrong idea about what's being discussed. And so regularly have to remind people about what the breaking news story is or who your guest is or something like that. And so Twitter actually behaves in a similar dynamics.
So let's talk about your book. Specifically, it's kind of a compendium of your coverage of the Arab Spring, and it elaborates on it a little bit. Given the form that you work in, why did you feel like you needed to write something long form to kind of bring it all together?
Well, initially I wanted to write the book because I felt the need to exercise my brain a bit and remind myself if it was truly possible for me to write more than 140 characters at a time. But I think more importantly, the reason why I did it was there are all these stories that would have fallen through the cracks if social media hadn't given people the ability to tell what was happening to them. But social media is also very ephemeral, and so as time passes, it can be very difficult to use search engines and other tools to find the stories that once passed through social media so quickly.
Give me an example. Like, let's talk about maybe Sami Ben Garbia, for example, who you call the Paul Revere of Tunisia.
Yes, Sami, he's an activist and a blogger who had spent about 13 years in exile prior to the Tunisian Revolution, and so he was living in Europe and used the internet as one of his primary ways to push back against the government. He was one of the first people to use digital maps, for example, to map out human rights violations across the country. And when the time came for the first protests that began in December 2010, Sami and his team, they essentially stayed up day and night collecting and documenting every bit of video and photos and everything else they could find online and spreading them across the internet, because at the time the Tunisian government would routinely block websites. And so if you wanted to watch protest videos on YouTube, for example, you'd be out of luck. And so what Sami would do is he and his team would upload them to multiple sites. So it wouldn't just be on YouTube. It would be on Dailymotion. It would be on Vimeo. It would be on Facebook. And so essentially the government couldn't keep up with their efforts to spread the word all over the place. In many ways, Sami and his team, they're actually representative of the many Paul Reveres that came out of Tunisia, because everyone in the country who had access to the internet, they also had the ability to spread information and help out with the revolution.
It's interesting. I mean, looking back on the Arab Spring now, we see that definitely social media made us a lot more aware of what was happening. It did affect the outcome in quite a number of contexts. I mean, looking back on it, what do you think has kind of been the lasting impact, though, of social media's role on those revolutions?
Well, I think the lasting impact has been disruption, for good and for ill. All of these countries that have experienced the Arab Spring, they're still struggling to figure out what they're going to evolve into. Many of them are finding themselves in crisis, especially the country like Egypt, whose government seems to lurch from one crisis to the next. Social media seems to be very good at disrupting situations such as overthrowing a government, but they're still trying to figure out how it can be used successfully to build a government. And they haven't been as successful when it comes to that. In some cases, I've heard, for example, members of the Muslim Brotherhood brag that they're not on Twitter. And they're not bragging because they want to tell the world that they're technophobes. In fact, they're not. The reason why they're saying it is because they recognize that the next phase of the revolution would be won by interacting and politicking in person rather than using social media. And so while many protesters continued to use Twitter to fight their fight, members of the Brotherhood were out canvassing potential voters, like out on the streets meeting people. There's this challenge that the protesters are facing right now where they still haven't achieved the goals of their revolutions, and they're reaching a point where social media may not necessarily be the best way to achieve the next steps they want to achieve.
Yeah, in a way, it kind of feels like they've hit the ceiling of what social media can achieve, especially, say, a country like Egypt was not fundamentally transformed by social media, which is something everybody thought was happening maybe in the moment during the Arab Spring.
It was easy to get swept up into this romantic narrative of Tahrir Square and social media and that this was going to cause the country to do a 180-degree turn. And, of course, that wasn't going to happen. You know, a country needs to build civil society and have a tolerance of dissent and disagreement. That tolerance has been lacking in Egypt, and so you continue to see infighting and boycotts and the like, and all the tweets in the world aren't going to change that.
Now, I want to ask you a bit about your work and your methods. It seemed during the Arab Spring, how your work kind of struck me is it seemed like it was a reporter's notebook just basically put out into the open. That's kind of what it struck me as, because when you're reporting, you write down little bits of rumors, you write down names, you write down sort of whatever information comes across, you know, your purview in a way, and then you sort it out after the fact. And a lot of people were maybe, you know, uncomfortable or surprised by that method that you used. I mean, how would you kind of describe what you do?
Well, yeah, I've often described it as kind of a collaborative newsroom or an open source newsroom, because I invite people to follow me on Twitter and interact with me to figure out what's true and what's not. Of course, in most newsrooms, all of that is happening behind the scenes. But the way I'm looking at it is that we used to live in a time where stories and rumors and other bits of information were very hard for the public to consume. You really had to get your information through the mainstream media. But with the advent of social media and so many other tools, those rumors fly left and right. And so the longer a newsroom waits while it's sorting out what's true and what's not, the more that information is being disseminated. And what I prefer to do is acknowledge that those rumors exist and then work with my Twitter followers to sort out and what's true. Because even though some people think it's spreading rumors, I prefer to think of it in many cases as putting the brakes on spreading it in certain circles so we can try to get a critical mass of people scrutinizing them more.
There has been some criticism sent your way about certain things that you've retweeted, even if it is something where you've acknowledged, well, this is a rumor that's happening right now. Do you think that as somebody at NPR, maybe you take on that authority where people would believe, well, hey, the guy from NPR is tweeting about it. This has to be something that's credible or true.
Well, you know, the complaints I got seemed to suggest that my tweets were completely in a vacuum and just saying, this is true, this is true, this is true, rather than acknowledging them as rumors. And that's not true at all. So, for example, take the Newtown shootings. There were many reports coming out of mainstream media that proved to be wrong. And so the tweets I put out were actually discussing those mainstream media reports and asking people if they had heard from other sources, if they'd seen anyone confirm it or deny it. And so, again, it's that idea of acknowledging that these rumors are out there and trying to put the brakes on them and have a discussion around them. And, I mean, it's not like I'm picking random rumors from social media and posting them without sourcing them.
Now, I have to ask, how many times have you tweeted during our interview?
Not once.
That's very respectful. That's very kind. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, unless there's an expectation in an interview that I'm going to be taking questions via social media, I'm old school about it. I actually like listening to the questions that are being asked of me.
Andy Carvin, it's been a real pleasure to get to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking this time.
Thanks. My pleasure. It's been good talking to you.
Andy Carvin is a senior strategist, whatever that title means, at NPR. His new book is called Distant Witness. You're listening to WYLL,